And this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Three Americans freed by North Korea arrive shortly at an Air Force base near Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in Pyongyang this week was able to gain their release. President Donald Trump will be among those on hand to greet them back home.
Flying back are three what they were calling hostages. We call them fine people, three really fine people. Seem to be healthy. They'll be landing at 2 o'clock in the morning at Andrews Air Force Base, and I'll be there to greet them.
Their freedom cleared an obstacle to a proposed meeting between Mr. Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is a White House spokesperson.
The president views this as a positive gesture and a step in the right direction from the North Korean leader. However, total denuclearization will remain the top priority.
The president said the date and location for that meeting with Mr. Kim will be released in a matter of days, but added it will not take place along the demilitarized zone separating the two Koreas.
We picked a time, we picked a place for the meeting, or summit, as you like to call it. And I think it'll be very successful. But as I always say, who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? But it's going to be a very important event.
Mr. Kim, in remarks carried by the state-run KCNA news agency Thursday, called the planned meeting historic and an excellent first step in building a good future on the Korean Peninsula. In Somalia, a suicide bomber killed at least 10 and wounded 10 others in a crowded market in Wanleyan, south of the capital, Mogadishu. There was no claim of responsibility, but the jihadist group Al-Shabaab is known to be operating in the area. Militants, meanwhile, from Al-Shabaab stoned a woman to death in the Sablale district in the Lower Shabelle region Wednesday after finding her guilty of being married to 11 men. This is VOA News. President Trump warned Iran Wednesday against restarting its nuclear weapons program a day after he announced the U.S. was withdrawing from the 2015 international nuclear agreement with Tehran.
Iran will find out. They're going to find out. I don't think they should do that. I would advise Iran not to start their nuclear program. I would advise them very strongly. If they do, there will be very severe consequences.
Mr. Trump said the U.S. would shortly reimpose economic sanctions waived under the 2015 deal.
And we will be putting on among the strongest sanctions that we've ever put on a country. And they're going into effect very shortly. They're mostly constituted and drawn already.
The other five signatories to the accord, Germany, Britain, France, Russia, and China, all voiced support for it. British Prime Minister Theresa May addressed Parliament Wednesday.
I have been very clear in a number of conversations with the President of the United States about the belief of the United Kingdom that the JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran, should stay.
French President Emmanuel Macron spoke with Iran's President Hassan Rouhani by phone, saying he wants to continue the accord in, quote, all its dimensions. Mr. Rouhani has warned his country could resume industrial enrichment without any limitations. In a speech Wednesday, Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said he has long insisted publicly and privately that America can't be trusted. Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak Thursday said he accepts the verdict of the people. Voters Wednesday turned out his National Front government, ending its dominance that extends back to 1957. Opposition leader, longtime former Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, and his Alliance of Hope emerged victorious.
So we have, in fact, achieved a very substantial majority, not just a few votes, not just a few seats, but a very substantial majority.
At 92, Mr. Mahathir has become the world's oldest elected leader. Israel's military said it hit dozens of Iranian military targets inside Syria Thursday after rockets struck Israeli frontline positions on the Golan Heights. No casualties and only slight damage reported. An Israeli spokesman said Iranian intelligence assets, logistics, storage, and vehicles, as well as the origin of the rockets, were hit. In Afghanistan, at least 7 people were killed, nearly 20 wounded in coordinated attacks in Kabul, affecting the city's main commercial area, lasting hours. A spokesman for the Taliban claimed responsibility for Wednesday's attack. At least 3 Mexican soldiers were killed, 3 others wounded Tuesday in an ambush in southern Guerrero State. Details of the attack were only made public Wednesday. Oil prices surged 3% Wednesday following the U.S. decision to quit the Iran nuclear deal. Both Brent and West Texas crude trading above $70 a barrel. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 10th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Togo's opposition coalition calls off yet another protest, but the government says it is all a sign that the protests are losing steam.
The problem of the coalition is that you have a group of many leaders that do not agree with each other, and now the population does not agree with them. So this is not a problem that the government can solve.
Gilbert Bawara is Togo's Minister for Public Administration. South Sudan's government reacts to a White House statement critical of the Juba administration. We'll examine the conflict in Liberia's communal land ownership and mining concessions. And the leaders of Kenya and Djibouti discuss regional security.
We live in a very troubled region. How we can cooperate together to secure our region, the prosperity of our people.
That's Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. An Egyptian woman launches an online radio show to help divorced women. And in Malawi, tackling rabies one dog at a time. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Togo's 14-party opposition coalition this week called off yet another protest, citing lack of security and blaming the government for changing the protest routes. The protesters have been demanding the resignation of President Faure Gnassingbé, in power since 2005, and a return to the country's 1992 constitution, which established a two-term limit for the presidency. The government said it changed the protest routes due to complaints from residents along the routes. But Gilbert Bawara, Togo's Minister for Public Administration, says the coalition called off the protest because it has been losing public support.
The fact is that most of the population, including their own people, does not understand anymore the objective and the aim of demonstration. There's a political dialogue underway, a dialogue which is being facilitated by Ghana and Guinea with the involvement of the ECOWAS. Now people does not understand anymore what can be achieved through demonstration. No one is ready to join the demonstration. So you cannot organize a demonstration when you don't have people who support you or who are able to mobilize for the demonstration. This is the most important problem. I think the coalition is confronted with its own contradiction. And the fact that neither the Togolese population nor the international opinion cannot understand anymore the aim and the objective of the demonstration. The coalition is free to organize demonstrations, but as is the case with any democratic country, they should organize their demonstration while taking into consideration the freedom of movement and the other activities, including economic activities of the population.
But so, Gilbert, you are blaming the coalition for calling off their protests and it being their own fault. It's your government that decided to change the route for the protesters to follow.
Yes, not that we decided to change the route and the places where they can organize demonstrations. But this is the case in any democratic countries. In Washington, in New York, in Paris, in Geneva, in Berlin, in London, there are some places where you cannot organize demonstrations. So this is not a particular case with Togo. The most important issue is that the coalition and any political party, including the civil society, they are free to organize demonstrations. But they should organize demonstrations while respecting any rule that is decided by the rule of law and the government. So we did not ban the demonstration. We just indicated that there are some places where demonstrations cannot take place. We have guaranteed the freedom of demonstration, the freedom of expression. Now, the most important problem is that the coalition does not have any more population, any more people who are ready to join them and to attend their demonstration.
That brings me to the dialogue. You said your government wonders why the coalition should continue to demonstrate when there is a dialogue. The last time we spoke to the opposition, they blamed the government for not being serious for the dialogue because they said you violated some of the agreements that led to the dialogue.
No, I don't see any violation that can be the responsibility of the government. People have to understand that it is not the government who can ask for the meeting to take place. It is the facilitation. Yesterday, before, it used to be Ghanaian facilitation who can call for meetings of the dialogue, and the government has always been ready to attend any meeting that the facilitation will call for. We have also been open to any compromise that can help improve the democracy and the rule of law. The problem of the coalition is that you have a group of many leaders that don't agree with each other, and now the population does not agree with them. So this is not a problem that the government can solve. So we continue to encourage them to be open, and we are open and ready to continue having the discussions and the political dialogue with the expectation that we will be able to reach a good compromise in the benefit of the country.
So far now, where are things in the dialogue? Is the dialogue dead, or when is it going to start again?
No, on the 27th of April, on the Independence Day of Togo, the president expressed our commitment to continue with the political dialogue. But now we can question the behavior and the way the coalition is acting. But we continue to be open to the dialogue.
Gilbert, thank you very much. It's so nice to talk with you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Gilbert Bawara is Togo's Minister for Public Administration. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lome. Kenya and Djibouti Wednesday signed a number of agreements aimed at boosting trade and expanding their bilateral relations. The agreements were signed at State House in Nairobi, where President Uhuru Kenyatta hosted Djibouti President Ismail Omar Guelleh, who is on a three-day state visit to Kenya. Reporter Maureen Ojiambo has details from Nairobi.
The agreements included trade, an MOU on bilateral cooperation in the livestock sector, reciprocal promotion and protection of investments. The two leaders also agreed to waive visas for diplomatic passport holders. The agreements were signed shortly after President Uhuru Kenyatta and President Guelleh held bilateral talks focusing on trade and security. President Kenyatta says the two nations face the same kind of challenges since they are in a region that has for decades been emaciated by conflicts and terrorism. Mr. Kenyatta says the partnership between Kenya and Djibouti has been strong and efforts were being made to make the cooperation more fruitful.
I'm certain that at the end of your visit, we will have had the opportunity to engage, to discuss on matters of bilateral interest and to see how we can strengthen our cooperation, especially given the fact, as we have just been discussing, that we live in a very troubled region, how we can cooperate together to secure our region for the prosperity of our people, how we can work together also to increase investment between our two countries and trade.
On the other hand, President Guelleh says Djibouti desires to strengthen partnership with Kenya in developing the region and making it peaceful. He says instability in Somalia continues to be a threat to the region, and Djibouti and Kenya were working together to make Somalia peaceful.
As you know, we in a very troubled region. We lack stability, we lack security, we are confronting extremism and violence in our region, and our participation has no selfish interest. We are sincere and we believe that it's our duty making our region safer. When anything occurs in neighboring countries, especially in Somalia, negative impact is immediate in our countries.
In an effort to promote greater economic cooperation, the two parties agreed to protect private or public investment in each other's country.
And trade, and how we can work together to share experiences and exchange technical know-how on a wide range of issues that can help grow both our economies, to say, please feel very much at home amongst your brothers and sisters in Kenya. So, Your Excellency, as we say in Kenya, Karibu Sana.
We are very grateful to you to give us the opportunity to strengthen our relationship, to find out every field of transforming our economies, taking our part of the development of the region.
President Gwele's visit comes shortly after a two-day state visit by Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Ali. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 10th. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. South Sudan's cabinet affairs minister says the United States should talk directly with the government of President Salva Kiir and avoid intimidation and threats. Martin Elias Lamoro was reacting to a White House statement issued earlier this week saying the South Sudan government has lost credibility and that the U.S. was reviewing its assistance to South Sudan. The White House also said the only path to peace in South Sudan is through a negotiated arrangement that would lead to an inclusive transitional government. As Nabio Biagio reports from Juba, Cabinet Affairs Minister Lamoro accuses the United States of favoring rebel groups while putting all blame for the continued fighting on the government.
Lamoro accuses the U.S. and other members of the international community of favoring the rebels while putting all the blame for the continued fighting and atrocities on the government.
The mistake people have made, unfortunately, the U.S. and other countries, including the Troika, they don't appreciate what actually happened. They're not able to ascribe precisely who was the culprit. And they have, therefore, to my mind, taken side. It's simply the government which is wrong. So it's the president who planned everything to happen. Riek Machar is innocent. The former detainees are innocent. There was no coup. That's where the problem started.
Lamoro insists the transitional government of national unity is inclusive, pointing out that some former detainees are still in the government.
John Luke is a member of the Council of Ministers, is the Minister of Transport. Biar Mudut is a member of Parliament. The Minister of Foreign Affairs chose to run away, and his position is there. I'm only acting. When he comes back, he'll take his position. Talking about Riek, Riek was not exiled by the government of South Sudan. I would like anybody to produce for me a document showing the government of South Sudan officially requested a country to exile Riek.
The White House statement condemns the leaders of South Sudan for killing their own citizens. Mark Weinberg is the public affairs officer at the U.S. Embassy in Juba.
The leaders of South Sudan have wasted their partnership with the United States and other international donors who supported this country from independence, have stolen the wealth of their own country, killed their own people, and demonstrated over and over again their unwillingness to live up to their commitments to end the war and uphold their obligations to allow unimpeded humanitarian access.
The White House statement says the only path to peace for South Sudan is through a negotiated arrangement for an inclusive government. Weinberg says the current transitional government of national unity does not represent all signatories to the 2015 peace agreement.
We no longer feel the transitional government of national unity is an inclusive government. Been the forced exile of key leadership representatives who signed the peace agreement in 2015. And to that end, the United States condemns any unilateral effort of the current government to extend its power, including through immediate elections. The United States does not believe that elections held in the current environment could be free and fair.
The White House statement says the promotion of UN-sanctioned individuals to top government positions, including General Jock Riak, Chief of Defense Forces, demonstrates Juba's disregard for international norms. Lamoro argues General Jock has done nothing to deserve the sanctions. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Political debate continues over Liberia's Land Rights Act, which traditional leaders say needs to change to better recognize community rights to their customary lands. While changes are still under debate, it's important to look at historical context and the idea of community ownership over land in the country, says international land tenure expert Liz Wiley. Wiley talks to Ricky Stryak about the friction created when mining developments and globalization clash with communal ownership in Liberia.
Like community-based tenure, which in Africa we tend to call customary tenure, there are basically five very globally consistent principles. One is they have a defined area. Two, the social entity and the land are sort of one. We are a community, this is our community land. But three, particularly where they are farming societies, the families within the community get what we call usufruct. They get exclusive rights to a particular parcel to build a hut or now a modern house or to farm land.
Do you think this idea that a community can be a title holder is still a barrier in Liberia at this point when we talk about mining concessions and things like that?
Well, no. And strictly speaking, the law already allows them to be.
When we say a community can be a landowner, though, who defines what the community and who is part of the community?
Communities are self-identifying and have their own rules, and always have. The rules change with each generation as needs change, but they generally have very clear rules about in which circumstances an outsider becomes a member of the community. And that's been under immense change.
When people come in from outside and try to get mining concessions or try to profit off the land, is it hard for these two ideas to reconcile, this idea of profiting, globalization and profiting off the land from in a place where community-based land ownership is the rule of law?
Yes. The answer is yes. And that is one of the major, there are two main reasons, but that is the first reason why there has been so much resistance in Liberia to this law, is there is a sense that there is a reluctance by the Liberian government and also by elites in society in Liberia to be tenants of communities, so the concession to be issued jointly by government and the landowner, the community. That's been a major issue. And that's where the assembly changed some of the terms in the land rights bill, so it suited more those interests and rather disempowered communities.
That was Liz Wiley, an international land tenure expert. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Nairobi. Facing social and legal hardships when she tried to end her marriage, an Egyptian woman decided to launch an online radio program to help others going through the same experience. 8 years later, the program continues to generate good advice. Mariama Diallo reports.
Mahassan Sabur, founder and host of Radio Divorces, points out she created the platform to help other women who face the same difficulties she did.
We tried to rehabilitate the divorced woman. We tried to rebuild her psychologically and within society by telling them about what's available, including government services, such as the National Council for Women and Child Centers.
She launched the online program 8 years ago to challenge the social stigma associated with divorce in Egypt.
From my experience and readings, I know a woman has the legitimate religious right to get a divorce. The problem is not about divorce itself, it's about what happens after divorce.
But not everyone is thrilled about the show. On the streets of the Egyptian capital, one resident says the program encourages women to seek divorce even after a small dispute.
When you see a woman who is liberated and calls for divorce and how beautiful it is and praises living without a husband, this deepens the wound of Arab families. We do not want to reach that level.
But another woman who went through a divorce defends the program's relevance.
Women are not only half the society, women are the entire society. She raises the minister, police officer, engineer, and the president. If she is psychologically stable and lives well, she will raise better generations.
Despite limited resources, about three dozen volunteers provide technical assistance to the nonprofit forum. Sabr's co-host Mai Ali says the program caters to the needs of other people as well.
It is concerned with the whole family, how to raise your child, and even for single women, we provide advice on how to choose your life partner and how we can be more positive in our life.
The program is also timely. The divorce rate is said to be rising in Egypt with nearly 200,000 cases in 2016, a 10% increase from 2015, according to the country's Central Agency for Public Mobilization and Statistics. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
A team of veterinarians has once again traveled to southern Malawi to vaccinate thousands of dogs as part of a global effort by the British charity Mission Rabies to eradicate the deadly virus by 2030. Malawi has in the past reported elevated numbers of child deaths from rabies. But now, 3 years into this initiative, the organizers say they are seeing signs of progress. Lamek Masinak reports for VOA from Blantyre.
Another massive vaccination campaign is underway in Malawi. The goal is to eradicate rabies in the African country. Dog bites are the source of nearly all rabies infections in humans. Mission Rabies has vaccinated about 250,000 dogs in Malawi since 2015.
We only had one person dying from within Blantyre City in 2017. So we did really have a big decrease in the number of rabies cases. But we also know it is an underreported disease. So often people wouldn't know what their child actually died of. Cerebral malaria is one of the diseases that can look very similar. So there are possibly more cases, but it definitely there has been a big decrease.
Mission Rabies swung into action after researchers reported in 2012 that five children had died of rabies in just 3 months at a single hospital in southern Malawi, the highest toll of any institution on the continent. Even when rabies infection is identified, clinics in Malawi often lack the necessary drugs to treat it. So this initiative has two aims: prevent dogs from getting infected and prevent children from getting bit. The team shows children how to avoid a dog attack and what actions to take if bitten by a potentially rabid dog.
We target children because most of the times children tend to stay close to dogs and play with them. And mostly they don't know what to do once they are bitten by the dog.
More than 1 million school children and their teachers have benefited from the lessons.
Even myself, I didn't even know that I should not disturb a dog who is eating. I have learned it today at this school.
The latest vaccination drive began in April. It's a job that is not without its challenges. With the owner's consent, the dogs are also sterilized.
Because if all the dogs that we vaccinate today, if they go off and have lots of puppies, all those puppies are unvaccinated, and then that dilutes the vaccination.
Mission Rabies aims to one day vaccinate at least 70% of dogs nationwide. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Kenya and Djibouti Wednesday signed a number of agreements aimed at boosting trade and expanding their bilateral relations. The agreements were signed at State House in Nairobi, where President Uhuru Kenyatta hosted Djibouti President Ismail Omar Guelleh, who is on a 3-day visit to Kenya. That is it for this Thursday, May 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, as Burundi prepares for a May 17th referendum to extend President Pierre Nkurunziza's time in office, it battles allegations of harassment committed against perceived opponents of the referendum. Critical times in Burundi on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty.
host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.